I want the files for everyone who ever worked with him, Sergei Nikolaevich ordered. And I want you to get me his personal file.
Yes, Comrade Chairman, Major Shalepin replied with a bob of his head. The morning briefing, delivered by a colonel of the militia, had pleased neither the SVR chairman nor his principal bodyguard. In this case, for a change, the legendarily slow Russian bureaucracy had been circumvented, and the information fast-tracked to those interested in it. That included the man whose life might have been spared accidentally after all.
And we will set up a special action group to work with this Provolov child.
Of course, Comrade Chairman. It was strange, Sergei Nikolaevich thought, how rapidly the world could change. He vividly remembered the morning of the murder. It was not the sort of thing a man could forget. But after the first few days of shock and attendant fear, he'd allowed himself to relax, to believe that this Avseyenko had been the real target of an underworld rubout, an archaic American term he liked, and that his own life had never been directly threatened. With the acceptance of that belief, the entire thing had become like driving past an ordinary traffic accident. Even if some unfortunate motorist had been killed there at the side of the road, you just dismissed it as an irrelevance, because that sort of thing couldn't happen to you in your own expensive official car, not with Anatoly driving. But now he'd begun to wonder if perhaps his life had been spared by accident. Such things were not supposed to occur. There shouldn't have been any need for them. Now he was more frightened than he'd been that bright Moscow morning, looking down from his window at the smoking wreck on the pavement. It meant that he might be in danger still, and he dreaded that prospect as much as the next man. Worse still, his hunter might well be one of his own, a former KGB officer with connections to Spetsnaz. And if he were in contact with the Chinese. But why would the Chinese wish to end his life? For that matter, why would the Chinese wish to perform any such crime in a foreign land? It was beyond imprudent. None of this made any sense. But as a career intelligence officer, Golovko had long since shed the illusion that the world was supposed to make sense. What he did know was that he needed more information. And at least he was in a very good place to seek it out. If he wasn't as powerful as he might once have been, he was still powerful enough for his own purposes, Golovko told himself. Probably. He didn't try to come to the ministry very often. It was just a routine security measure, but a sensible one. Once you recruited an agent, you didn't want to hang out with him or her for fear of compromise. That was one of the things they taught you at the farm. If you compromised one of your agents, you might have trouble sleeping at night, because CIA was usually active in countries where the Miranda warning was delivered by a gun or knife or fist, or something just as bad. As unpleasant as a police state could make it. And that, the instructors had told his class, could be pretty fucking unpleasant. Especially in a case like this, he was intimate with this agent, and breaking away from her could cause her to stop her cooperation, which Langley had told him was pretty damned good, and they wanted more of it. Erasing the program he'd had her input on her machine would be difficult for a Caltech-trained genius. But you could accomplish the same thing by clobbering the whole hard drive and reinstalling new files over the old ones. Because the valuable little gopher file was hidden in the system software, and a write-over would destroy it as surely as the San Francisco earthquake. So he didn't want to be here exactly, but he was a businessman, in addition to being a spook, and the client had called him in. The girl two desks away from Ming had a computer problem, and he was the NEC rep for the ministry offices. It turned out to be a minor problem. You just couldn't turn some women loose on computers. It was like loosing a 4-year-old in a gun shop, he thought, but didn't dare say such things aloud in these liberated times, even here. Happily, Ming hadn't been in sight when he'd come in. He'd walked over to the desk with the problem and fixed it in about 3 minutes, explaining the error to the secretary in simple terms she was sure to understand, and which would now make her the office expert for an easily replicated problem. With a smile and a polite Japanese bow, he'd made his way to the door. When the door to the inner office opened, and Ming came out with her Minister Fang behind her, looking down at some papers.
"Oh, hello, Nomori-san,"
Ming said in surprise, as Fang called the name Chai, and waved to another of the girls to follow him in. If Fang saw Nomori there, he didn't acknowledge it, simply disappeared back into his private office.
"Hello, Comrade Ming," the American said, speaking in English. "Your computer operates properly?"
he asked, formally.
"Yes, it does, thank you."
"Good. Well, if you experience a problem, you have my card."
"Oh, yes.
You are well settled into Beijing now?"
she asked politely.
"Yes, thank you, I am."
"You should try Chinese food instead of sticking to the food of your homeland, though I admit I have developed a taste lately for Japanese sausage,"
she told him, and everyone else in the room, with a face that would have done Amarillo Slim proud.
For his part, Chester Nomori felt his heart not so much skip a beat as stop entirely for about 10 seconds, or so it seemed.
"Ah, yes,"
he had to say in reply, as soon as he got breath back in his lungs.
"It can be very tasty."
Ming just nodded and went to her desk and back to work. Nomori nodded and bowed politely to the office and made his departure as well, then headed down the corridor immediately for a men's room, the need to urinate urgent.
Sweet Jesus!
But that was one of the problems with agents. They sometimes got off on their work, the way a drug addict got off on the immediate rush when the chemical hit his system. And they'd tickle the dragon with their new and playful enthusiasm just to experience a little more of the rush, forgetting that the dragon's tail was a lot closer to its mouth than it appeared. It was foolish to enjoy danger. Zipping himself back up, he told himself that he hadn't broken training, hadn't stumbled on his reply to her playful observation. But he had to warn her about dancing in a minefield. You never really knew where to put your feet, and discovering the wrong places was usually painful. That's when he realized why it had happened, and the thought stopped him dead in his tracks. Ming loved him. She was playful because, well, why else would she have said that? As a game? Did she regard the whole thing as a game? No, she wasn't the right personality type to be a hooker. The sex had been good. Maybe too good, if such a thing were possible, Nomori thought as he resumed walking toward the elevator. She'd surely be over tonight after saying that. He'd have to stop by the liquor store on the way home and get some more of that awful Japanese scotch for $30 a liter. A working man couldn't afford to get drunk here unless he drank the local stuff, and that was too vile to contemplate. But Ming had just consecrated their relationship by risking her life in front of her minister and her co-workers, and that was far more frightening to Nomori than her ill-considered remark about his dick and her fondness for it. Jesus, he thought, this is getting too serious. But what could he do now? He'd seduced her and made a spy of her, and she'd fallen for him for no better reason, probably, than that he was younger than the old fucker she worked for, and was far nicer to her. Okay, so he was pretty good in the sack, and that was excellent for his male ego. And he was a stranger in a strange land, and he had to get his rocks off, too, and doing it with her was probably safer to his cover than picking up some hooker in a bar. And he didn't even want to consider getting seriously involved with a real girl in his real life. But how was this so different from that? He asked himself. Aside from the fact that while she was loving him, her computer was sending her transcribed notes off into the ether world. It was doing it again soon after the close of regular business hours, and the 11-hour differential pretty much guaranteed that it arrived on the desks of American officials soon after their breakfasts. In the case of Mary Patricia Foley, Mornings were far less hectic than they'd once been. Her youngest was not yet in college, but preferred to fix her own oatmeal from the Quaker envelopes, and now drove herself to school, which allowed her mother an extra 25 minutes or so of additional sleep every morning. 20 years of being a field spook and mother should have been enough to drive her to distracted insanity. But it was, actually, a life she'd enjoyed, especially her years in Moscow, doing her business right there in the belly of the beast, and giving the bastard quite an ulcer at the time, she remembered with a smile. Her husband could say much the same. The first husband-wife team to rise so high at Langley, they drove together to work every morning, in their own car rather than the company one, to which they were entitled, but with lead and chase cars full of people with guns, because any terrorist with half a brain would regard them as targets more valuable than rubies. This way they could talk on the way in, and the car was swept for bugs on a weekly basis. They took their usual reserved and oversized place in the basement of the old headquarters building, then rode up in the executive elevator, which somehow was always waiting for them, to their seventh-floor offices. Mrs. Foley's desk was always arrayed just so. The overnight crew had all her important papers arranged just so also. But today, as she had for the last week, instead of looking over the striped border folders full of top-secret code-worded material, she first of all flipped on her desktop computer and checked her special email. This morning was no disappointment. She copied the file electronically to her hard drive, printed up a hard copy, and when that was off her printer, deleted the email from her system, effectively erasing it from electronic existence. Then she reread the paper copy and lifted the phone for her husband's office. "Yeah, baby?" "Some egg drop soup," she told the director of Central Intelligence. It was a Chinese dish he found especially vile, and she enjoyed teasing her husband. "Okay, honey, come on in." It had to be pretty good if she was trying to turn his stomach over this early in the friggin' morning, the DCI knew. "More sorga?" the president asked, 75 minutes later. "Yes, sir," Ben Goodley replied, handing the sheet over. It wasn't long, but it was interesting. Ryan skimmed through it. "Analysis?" "Mrs. Foley wants to go over it with you this afternoon. You have a slot at 2:15. "Okay, who else?" "The vice president, since he's around." Goodley knew that Ryan liked to have Robbie Jackson in for strategically interesting material. "He's fairly free this afternoon as well." "Good. Set it up," POTUS ordered. 6 blocks away, Dan Murray was just arriving at his capacious office, considerably larger than the president's, as a matter of fact, with his own security detail, because he, as the country's principal counterintelligence and counter-terrorist officer, had all manner of information that others were interested in. This morning only brought in some more. "Morning, Director," one of the staff said. She was a sworn agent carrying a sidearm, not just a secretary. "Hey, Tony," Murray responded. This agent had very nice wheels, but the FBI director realized that he'd just proven to himself that his wife Liz was right. He was turning into a dirty old man. The piles on the desk were arranged by the overnight staff, and there was a routine for this. The rightward-most pile was for intelligence-related material, the leftward-most for counterintelligence operations, and the big one in the middle was for ongoing criminal investigations requiring his personal attention or notification. That tradition went back to Mr. Hoover, as he was remembered at the FBI, who seemingly went over every field case bigger than the theft of used cars off the government parking lot. But Murray had long worked the black side of the bureau, and that meant he attacked the rightward pile first. There wasn't much there. The FBI was running some of its own pure intelligence operations at the moment,
somewhat to the discomfort of CIA. But those two government agencies had never gotten along terribly well, even though Murray rather liked the Foleys. What the hell, he thought. A little competition was good for everybody, so long as CIA didn't mess with a criminal investigation, which would be a very different kettle of fish. The top report was from Mike Riley in Moscow.
Damn, Murray breathed.
Then an inward smile. Murray had personally selected Riley for the Moscow slot over the objections of some of his senior people, who had all wanted Paul Landau out of the intelligence division. But no, Murray had decided, Moscow needed help with cop work, not spy chasing, at which they had lots of good experience. And so he'd sent Mike, a second-generation agent who, like his father, Pat Riley, had given the mafia in New York City a serious case of indigestion. Landau was now in Berlin, playing with the German Bundeskriminalamt, the BKA, doing regular crime liaison stuff, and doing it pretty well. But Riley was a potential star. His dad had retired an ASAC. Mike would do better than that. And the way he'd bonded with this Russian detective, Provolov, wouldn't hurt his career one bit. So, they'd uncovered a link between a former KGB officer and the Chinese MSSA, and this was part of the investigation into the big kaboom in Moscow. Jesus, could the Chinese have had a part in that? If so, what the hell did that mean? Now, this was something the Foleys had to see. To that end, Director Murray lifted his phone. 10 minutes later, the Moscow document slid into his secure fax machine to Langley. And, just to make sure that CIA didn't take credit for an FBI job, a hard copy was hand-carried to the White House, where it was handed to Dr. Benjamin Goodley, who'd surely show it to the President before lunch. It had gotten to the point that he recognized her knock at the door. Nomori set his drink down and jumped to answer, pulling it open less than 5 seconds after the first sexy tap-tap.
"Ming,"
Chet said.
"Nomori-san,"
she greeted in turn. He pulled her in the door, closed and locked it. Then he lifted her off the floor with a passionate hug that was less than 3% feigned. "So you have a taste for Japanese sausage, eh?" he demanded, with a smile and a kiss.
"You didn't even smile when I said it."
"Wasn't it funny?" she asked, as he undid a few of her buttons.
"Ming."
He hesitated and tried something he'd learned earlier in the day.
"Baobei,"
he said instead. It translated to "beloved one." Ming smiled at the words and made her own reply.
"Shingan,"
which literally meant heart and liver, but in context meant heart and soul.
"Beloved one," Nomori said after a kiss.
"Do you advertise our relationship at your office?"
"No. Minister Fang might not approve. But the other girls in the office probably would not object if they found out,"
she explained with a coquettish smile.
"But you never know."
"Then why risk exposing yourself by making such a joke, unless you wish me to betray you?"
"You have no sense of humor," Ming observed.
But then she ran her hands under his shirt and up his chest. "But that is all right. You have the other things I need." Afterward, it was time to do business.
"Baobei?" "Yes?"
"Your computer still works properly?"
"Oh, yes,"
she assured him in a sleepy voice. His left hand stroked her body gently. "Do any of the other girls in the office use their computers to surf the net?"
"Only Chai. Fang uses her as he uses me. In fact, he likes her better. He thinks she has a better mouth."
"Oh?" Nomori asked, softening the question with a smile.
"I told you, Minister Fang is an old man. Sometimes he needs special encouragement, and Chai doesn't mind so much. Fang reminds her of her grandfather, she says, Ming told him. Which was good in the American's mind for a yuck and little else.
So, all the girls in the office trade notes on your minister?
Ming laughed. It was pretty funny.
Of course. We all do.
Damn, Nomori thought. He'd always thought that women would be more discreet. That it was just the men who bragged in the locker room over their sweat socks.
The first time he did me, she went on, I didn't know what to do. So I talked with Chai for advice. She's been there the longest, you see. She just said to enjoy it and try to make him happy, and I might get a nice office chair out of it, like she did. Chai must be very good to him. She got a new bicycle last November. Me, well, I think he only likes me because I'm a little different to look at. Chai has bigger breasts than I do, and I think I'm prettier. But she has a sweet disposition, and she likes the old man. More than I do, anyway. She paused. I don't want a new bicycle enough for that.
What does this mean? Robbie Jackson asked.
Well, we're not sure, the DCI admitted. This Fung guy had a long talk with our old friend Zhang Hansan. They're talking about the meeting with our trade team that starts tomorrow.
Hell, Ed Foley looked at his watch, call that 14 hours from now.
And it looks as though they want concessions from us instead of offering any to us. They're even angrier over our recognition of Taiwan than we'd anticipated.
Tough shit, Ryan observed.
Jack, I agree with your sentiment, but let's try not to be over-cavalier about their opinions, shall we? Foley suggested.
You're starting to sound like Scott, the president said.
So, you want a yes-man handling Langley? You got the wrong guy, the DCI countered.
Fair enough, Ed, Jack conceded. Go on.
Jack, we need to warn Rutledge that the PRC isn't going to like what he has to say. They may not be in a mood to make any trade concessions.
Well, neither is the United States of America, Ryan told his director of Central Intelligence. And we come back to the fact that they need our money more than we need their trade goods.
What's the chance that this is a setup? This information, I mean, Vice President Jackson asked.
You mean that they're using this source as a conduit to get back-channel information to us? Mary Patricia Foley asked.
I evaluate that chance as practically zero, as close to zero as something in the real world can be.
MP, how can you be that confident? President Ryan asked.
Not here, Jack, but I am that confident, Mary Pat said, somewhat to the discomfort of her husband, Ryan saw.
It was rare in the intelligence community for anyone to feel that confident about anything. But Ed had always been the careful one, and Mary Pat had always been the cowgirl. She was as loyal to her people as a mother was to her infant. And Ryan admired that, even though he also had to remind himself that it wasn't always realistic.
Ed? Ryan asked, just to see.
I back Mary up on this one. This source appears to be gold-plated and copper-bottomed.
So, this document represents the view of their government? Tomcat asked.
Foley surprised the vice president by shaking his head.
No, it represents the view of this Zhang Hansan guy. He's a powerful and influential minister, but he doesn't speak for their government per se. Note that the text here doesn't say what their official position is. Zhang probably does represent a view, and a powerful view, inside their Politburo. There are also moderates whose position this document does not address.
Okay, great, Robbie said, shifting in his seat. So why are you taking up our time with this stuff, then?
This Zhang guy is tight with their defense minister. In fact, he has a major voice in their entire national security establishment. If he's expanding his influence into trade policy, we have a problem. And our trade negotiations team needs to know that up front, the DCI informed them.
So,
Ming asked tiredly. She hated getting dressed and leaving, and it meant a night of not enough sleep.
So you should get in early and upload this on Chai's computer. It's just a new system file, the new one, 6.8.1, like the one I uploaded on your computer.
In fact, the newest real system file was 6.3.2, and so there was at least a year until a write-over would actually be necessary.
Why do you have me do this?
Does it matter, Baobei? He asked. She actually hesitated, thinking it over a bit, and the second or so of uncertainty chilled the American spy.
No, I suppose not. I need to get you some new things, Nomori whispered, taking her in his arms.
Like what? She asked.
All his previous gifts had been noteworthy.
It will be a surprise, and a good one, he promised.
Her dark eyes sparkled with anticipation. Nomori helped her on with her dreadful jacket. Dressing her back up was not nearly as fun as undressing her, but that was to be expected. A moment later he gave her the final goodbye kiss at the door, and watched her depart, then went back to his computer to tell Pat's Bakery at BrownieNet.com that he'd arranged for a second recipe that he hoped she might find tasty.
Chapter 22 The Table and the Recipe.
Minister, this is a pleasure, Cliff Rutledge said in his friendliest diplomatic voice, shaking hands. Rutledge was glad the PRC had adopted the Western custom. He'd never learned the exact protocol of bowing. Carl Hitch, the U.S. ambassador to the People's Republic, was there for the opening ceremony. He was a career Foreign Service officer who'd always preferred working abroad to working at Foggy Bottom. Running day-to-day diplomatic relations wasn't especially exciting, but in a place like this it did require a steady hand. Hitch had that, and he was apparently well-liked by the rest of the diplomatic community, which didn't hurt. It was all new for Mark Gant, however. The room was impressive, like the boardroom of a major corporation, designed to keep the board members happy, like noblemen from medieval Italy. It had high ceilings and fabric-covered walls. Chinese silk, in this case. Red, of course, so that the effect was rather like crawling inside the heart of a whale, complete with chandeliers, cut crystal, and polished brass. Everyone had a tiny glass of Mao Tai, which really was like drinking flavored lighter fluid, as he'd been warned.
"It is your first time in Beijing?" some minor official asked him.
Gant turned to look down at the little guy.
"Yes, it is."
"Too soon for first impressions, then?"
"Yes, but this room is quite stunning. But then silk is something with which your people have a long and fruitful history," he went on, wondering if he sounded diplomatic or merely awkward.
"This is so, yes," the official agreed with a toothy grin and a nod, neither of which told the visiting American much of anything, except that he didn't waste much money on toothbrushes.
"I have heard much of the Imperial Art Collection."
"You will see it," the official promised. "It is part of the official program."
"Excellent. In addition to my duties, I would like to play tourist."
"I hope you will find us acceptable hosts," the little guy said.
For his part, Gant was wondering if this smiling, bowing dwarf would hit his knees and offer a blowjob. But diplomacy was an entirely new area for him. These were not investment bankers who were generally polite sharks, giving you good food and drink before sitting you down and trying to bite your dick off. But they never concealed the fact that they were sharks. These people, he just wasn't sure. This degree of politeness and solicitude was a new experience for Gant. But given his pre-mission brief, he wondered if the hospitality only presaged an unusually hostile meeting when they got to business. If the two things had to balance out, then the downside of this seesaw was going to be a son of a bitch, he was sure.
So you are not from the American State Department? The Chinese man asked.
No, I'm in the Department of the Treasury. I work directly for Secretary Winston.
Ah, then you are from the trading business.
So the little bastard's been briefed.
But that was to be expected.
At this level of government, you didn't freelance things. Everyone would be thoroughly briefed. Everyone would have read the book on the Americans. The State Department members of the American crew had done the same. Gant, however, had not, since he wasn't really a player, per se, and had only been told what he needed to know. That gave him an advantage over the Chinese assigned to look after him. He was not State Department, hence should not have been regarded as important. But he was the personal representative of a very senior American official, known to be part of that man's inner circle, and that made him very important indeed. Perhaps he was even a principal advisor to the Rutledge man. And, in a Chinese context, that might even mean that he, Gant, was the man actually running the negotiations, rather than the titular chief diplomat, because the Chinese often ran things that way. It occurred to Gant that maybe he could fuck with their minds a little bit, but how to go about it? Oh yes, I've been a capitalist all my life, Gant said, deciding to play it cool and just talk to the guy as though he were a human being and not a fucking communist diplomat. So has Secretary Winston, and so has our president, you know.
But he was mainly an intelligence officer, or so I have been told.
Time to stick the needle.
I suppose that's partly true, but his heart is in business, I think. After he leaves government service, he and George will probably go into business together and really take the world over.
Which was almost true, Gant thought, remembering that the best lies usually were.
And you have worked some years with Secretary Winston.
A statement rather than a question, Gant noted. How to answer it? How much did they really know about him? Or was he a man of mystery to the Chi-Coms? If so, could he make that work for him?
A gentle, knowing smile.
Well, yeah, George and I made a little money together. When Jack brought him into the cabinet, George decided that he wanted me to come down with him and help make a little government policy, especially tax policy. That's been a real mess, and George turned me loose on it. And you know, we just might get all of that changed. It looks as though Congress is going to do what we told them to do. And that's not bad, making those idiots do what we want them to do, Gant observed, looking rather deliberately at the carved ivory fixture on the wooden display cabinet. Some craftsman with a sharp knife had spent a lot of time to get that thing just right.
So, Mr. Chinaman, do I look important now?
One thing about this guy, he would have been a pretty good poker player. His eyes told you nothing at all. Not a fucking thing. Gant looked down at the guy again.
"Excuse me, I talk too much."
The official smiled.
"There is much of that at times like this. Why do you suppose everyone gets something to drink?"
Amusement in his voice, letting Gant know, perhaps, who was really running this affair.
"I suppose," Gant observed diffidently, and wandered off with the junior, or was he, official in tow.
For his part, Rutledge was trying to decide if the opposition knew what his instructions were. There had been a few leaked hints in the media, but Adler had arranged the leaks with skill, so that even a careful observer, and the PRC ambassador in Washington was one of those, might have trouble deciding who was leaking what, and to what purpose. The Ryan administration had utilized the press with a fair degree of skill, probably, Rutledge thought, because the cabinet officers mainly took their lead from Ryan's chief of staff, Arnie Van Dam, who was a very skillful political operator. The new cabinet didn't have the usual collection of in-and-out political figures who needed to stroke the press to further their own agendas. Ryan had chiefly selected people with no real agenda at all, which was no small feat, especially since most of them seemed to be competent technicians who, like Ryan, only seemed to want to escape Washington with their virtue intact and return to their real lives as soon as they finished serving their country for a short period of time. The career diplomat had not thought it possible that his country's government could be so transformed. He assigned credit for all this to that madman Japanese pilot who'd killed so much of official Washington in that one lunatic gesture. It was then that Xu Kunpiao showed up, sweeping into the greeting room with his official entourage. Xu was General Secretary of the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China, and chairman of the Chinese Politburo, though referred to in the media as the country's premier, which was something of a misnomer, but one adopted even in the diplomatic community. He was a man of 71 years, one of the second generation of Chinese leaders. The Long March survivors had long since died out. There were some senior officials who claimed to have been there, but a check of the numbers showed that if they had, they'd been sucking their mother's nipples at the time, and those men were not taken seriously. No, the current crop of Chinese political leaders were mainly the sons or nephews of the original set, raised in privilege and relative comfort, but always mindful of the fact that their place in life was a precarious one. On one side were the other political children who craved advancement beyond their parents' places, and, to achieve that, they'd been more Catholic than the local communist pope. They'd carried their little red books high as adults during the Cultural Revolution, and before that, they'd kept their mouths shut and ears open during the abortive and predatory Hundred Flowers campaign of the late 50s, which had trapped a lot of intellectuals who'd thought to keep hidden for the first decade of Maoist rule. They'd been enticed into the open by Mao's own solicitation for their ideas, which they'd foolishly given out, and in the process only extended their necks over the broad block for the axe that fell a few years later in the brutal, cannibalistic Cultural Revolution. The current Politburo members had survived in two ways. First, they'd been secured by their fathers and the rank that attached to such lofty parentage. Second, they'd been carefully warned about what they could say and what they could not say. And so all along they'd observed cautiously, always saying out loud that Chairman Mao's ideas were those which China really needed, and that the others, while interesting, perhaps, in a narrow intellectual sense, were dangerous insofar as they distracted the workers and peasants from the true way of Mao. And so when the axe had fallen, borne as it had been by the little red book, they'd been among the first to carry and show that book to others, and so escaped the destruction for the most part. A few of their number had been sacrificed, of course, but none of the really smart ones who now shared the seats on the Politburo. It had been a brutal Darwinian process that they had all gotten through by being a little smarter than those around them. And now, at the peak of the power won for them by brains and caution, it was time for them to enjoy that which they'd earned. The new crop of leaders accepted communism as truly as other men believed in God, because they'd learned nothing else, and had not exercised their intellectual agility to seek another faith, or even to seek solutions to the questions that Marxism could not answer. Theirs was a faith of resignation rather than enthusiasm. Raised within a circumscribed intellectual box, they never ventured out of it, for they feared what they might find out there. In the past 20 years, they'd been forced to allow capitalism to blossom within the borders of their country, because that country needed money to grow into something more powerful than the failed experiment in the Democratic Republic of Korea. China had experienced its own killer famine around 1960, and slowly learned from it. And the Chinese also used it as a launching point for the Cultural Revolution, thus gaining political capital from a self-imposed disaster. They wanted their nation to be great. In fact, they already regarded it as such, but recognized the fact that other nations lacked this appreciation, and so they had to seek out the means to correct the misimpression foolishly held by the rest of the world. That had meant money. And money had meant industry, and industry required capitalists. It was something they had figured out before the foolish Soviets to their north and west. And so the Soviet Union had fallen, but the People's Republic of China remained. or so they all believed. They looked out, when they bothered themselves to do so, at a world that they pretended to understand, and to which they felt superior for no better reason than their skin and their language. Ideology came second in their self-reckoning. Amor propre starts from within. They expected people to defer to them, and the previous years of interactive diplomacy with the surrounding world had not altered their outlook very much. But in this they suffered from their own illusions. Henry Kissinger had come to China in 1971 at the behest of President Richard Nixon, not so much from his perceived need to establish normal relations with the world's most populous nation, as to use the PRC as a stick with which to beat the Soviet Union into submission. In fact, Nixon had begun a process so lengthy as to be considered beyond Western capabilities. It was more the sort of thing that Westerners thought the Chinese themselves capable of conceiving. With such ideas, people merely show ethnic prejudices of one sort or another. The typical chief of a totalitarian government is far too self-centered to think much beyond his own lifetime. And men all over the world live roughly the same number of years. For that simple reason, they all think in terms of programs that can be completed in their own living sight, and little beyond, because they were all men who'd torn down the statues of others, and such men had few illusions over the fate of their own monuments. It was only as they faced death that they considered what they had done, and Mao had conceded bleakly to Henry Kissinger that all he'd accomplished had been to change the lives of peasants within a few miles of Beijing. But the men in this ceremonial room were not yet close enough to death to think in such terms. They were the magisters of their land. They made the rules that others followed. Their words were law. Their whims were granted with alacrity. People looked upon them as they once looked upon the emperors and princes of old. All a man could wish to have, they had. Most of all, they had the power. It was their wishes that ruled their vast and ancient land. Their communist ideology was merely the magic that defined the form their wishes took, the rules of the game they had all agreed to play all those years before. The power was the thing. They could grant life or take it with the stroke of a pen, or, more realistically, a dictated word, taken down by a personal secretary, for transmission to the underling who squeezed the trigger. Xu was a man of average everything, height, weight, eyes, and face. And intellect, some said. Rutledge had read all this in his briefing documents. The real power was elsewhere. Xu was a figurehead of sorts, chosen for his looks, partially, his ability to give a speech, certainly, and his ability to front the occasional idea of others on the Politburo, to simulate conviction. Like a Hollywood actor, he didn't so much have to be smart as to play smart. "Comrade Premier," Rutledge said in greeting, holding out his hand, which the Chinese man took. "Mr. Rutledge," Xu replied in passable English. There was an interpreter there, too, for the more complex thoughts. "Welcome to Beijing. It is my pleasure and my honor to visit your ancient country again," the American diplomat said, showing proper respect and subservience, the Chinese leader thought. "It is always a pleasure to welcome a friend," Xu went on, as he'd been briefed to do. Rutledge had been to China before in his official capacity, but never before as a delegation leader. He was known to the Chinese Foreign Ministry as a diplomat who'd climbed his way up the ladder of his bureaucracy, much as they did in their own. A mere technician, but a high-ranking one. The Politburo chief raised his glass.